Hello and a warm welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, broadcasting live from Studio One here in London. I'm Emma Nelson. In the next 60 minutes, we assess why some academics are trying to start a so-called Yale Spring. As South Korea stands to elect its first North Korean, we look at the politics of defection. And we soft-shoe shuffle over the road from Midori House to meet the neighbours, where anything goes on the dance floor.
We teach the tango, the waltz, the foxtrot, the quickstep, rumba, cha-cha, pasodoble, samba, jive, swing, merengue, salsa, bachata, and a few other dances.
And after we've relaxed and sat down after all that, we'll talk to Monocle's culture editor Robert Bound, who'll be running us through the week's cultural events and best music. All that, plus some music too, right here on Midori House on Monocle 24. All that ahead in the next 60 minutes, but before that, here's the news with James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. The UN Security Council has agreed to a statement calling on Syria to comply with a forthcoming deadline to halt fighting and withdraw its forces from centres of population. Susan Rice, US ambassador to the UN, read out the statement to the full council and called on Syria to fulfil three specific requirements.
To A, cease troop movements toward population centres. B, cease all use of heavy weapons in such centres. And C, begin pullback of military concentrations in and around population centers.
Mrs. Rice said if Syria was not willing to comply with the demands in the statement, then the Security Council would consider further steps. Meanwhile, the opposition Syrian Observatory for Human Rights has reported that at least 33 people, including 14 soldiers, have been killed, 16 of them in the city of Homs and 14 in Idlib province. The UN Arab League envoy Kofi Annan reminded all sides in the Syrian conflict that the deadline must be obeyed.
Upon completion by the government of its commitments by Tuesday, 10 April, all parties should move immediately to cease all forms of violence so that a complete cessation is in place by 0600 hours, Damascus time, on Thursday, April 12.
Greek bank shareholders are under pressure from Athens to contribute billions of euros to recapitalise the lenders so that the government can avoid taking them over. Investors will find out next week the details of the financial support package on offer from the Greek government, which desperately wants to keep the banks in private hands. The terms are likely to determine whether shareholders decide to take part. If they refuse the offer, the Greek state could end up owning the banks. In a worst-case scenario, 50 billion euros, or a quarter of Greece's gross domestic product, may be required to shore up the banking system. The French president, Nicolas Sarkozy, has published his economic manifesto for re-election, promising spending cuts and a new law committing France to balanced budgets. Recent opinion polls suggest he's moved slightly ahead of his main rival, the socialist François Hollande, but analysts believe Mr. Hollande still seems likely to win the second round. Support for Mr. Sarkozy has increased since an Islamist gunman attacked soldiers and a Jewish school in March. The first round of voting will take place in less than 3 weeks' time. Around 200 reporters who covered the war in Bosnia have gathered in Sarajevo to mark the 20th anniversary of the beginning of the siege of the city, the longest siege of a capital in modern history. Popular understanding in the Western democracies about what the war was about was often wrong, according to the correspondent Roy Gutman, who covered the Bosnian War. He said the situation in its aftermath remained outrageous.
I'm really sad that the system set up at Dayton has left the country in such a mess, and the people in such a mess, and I think it's outrageous, and I think Western governments, starting with the Americans, should do the responsible thing and revise it.
The anti-Konya group, Invisible Children, has released a new video as a follow-up to the viral Konya 2012 film, aimed at waking up the world to atrocities committed by the Ugandan rebel leader Joseph Konya and his Lord's Resistance Army. A spokesperson for Invisible Children said he wanted people to dig deeper into the conflict and actively engage in the solutions. Those are the main stories here at Monocle 24.
James, thank you very much indeed. Now let's get the latest World Weather Report with Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
Well, in Europe, it remains a little on the chilly side. Here in the UK, we've had some snow, but no further snow is expected. However, in Scandinavia and Eastern Europe, even colder weather is on the way. Spain is not especially warm and sunny either. Highs here only around about the mid-teens. For example, in Barcelona, the Balkans, this is where the warm weather is. Here's Friday's city outlook. In London, 11 degrees, rather cloudy. Munich, 9 degrees, some rain here. Prague, 8 Celsius, cloudy. And in Helsinki, it's around zero and there will be some snow flurries about. Now, North America, if you've been following the weather headlines, you'll be aware of all the tornadoes. It's still looking potentially quite mild for a time, but the good news is that the storms are, at least for now, dying out. Very good weather currently across the Midwest, southern Canada, and from New England to the mid-Atlantic states. Now to Friday's city outlook. New York City, 16 degrees, sunny and staying like it all into the weekend. Washington, D.C., similar, 17 and sunny. Chicago, 12 degrees with sunny skies. And in L.A., blue skies too, plenty of sun, 21 degrees. We'll take a look at some world holiday spots. Now in Hawaii and Honolulu, it's around 26 degrees, fairly sunny too. It'll stay like it into the weekend. Very breezy, so a high surf here. In Cuba and Havana, a good chance of tropical downpours in the coming days, but sunshine too, for sure. Highs around 30 degrees. And in Dubai, a sunny weekend and 30. That's all. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Just coming up to 7 minutes past the hour here on Monocle 24, and you're listening to Midori House.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse é Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Ein Monocle 24 Tagat, ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 ja jokossa.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Propojalava.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And we begin today with a story about a defector who's making his mark across the border. Because he was once a member of North Korea's political elite, now almost two decades after he defected, Cho Myung-chun stands to become the first North Korean to be elected to public office in South Korea. Mr. Cho is one of 23,000 North Koreans who live in South Korea. He says he's trying to set an example to those people, including his wife, who's left behind, who still live across the border. Well, to tell us more, I'm joined by John Park. He's research fellow at Harvard's Belfer Center. Welcome to Midori House, John. Let's just start by asking, how remarkable is Mr. Cho's rise to power?
Emma, this is a story that even a few years ago would have been unthinkable. If you look at the defector community, as you mentioned, there are 23,000 defectors in South Korea, and many of them are very much marginalized in South Korea. In the earlier phase of their flow in terms of immigrating to Korea, to South Korea, and the population of the defectors were small, there was a great deal of support and sympathy from the South Korean public. But as their numbers became larger and larger, they were viewed with a certain degree of hostility and also suspicion given the two North Korean attacks against South Korea in 2010. So Mr. Cho's story, again, is something that is remarkable, but also a large testimony to the vibrant democracy in South Korea.
So what political obstacles will someone like Mr. Cho, as a defector, have to overcome to be accepted? Or is this being heralded as a step forward for diversity in South Korea?
With respect to Mr. Cho's background, he is unique in the sense that he actually was head of a South Korean government organization. It's state-run. It was called the Education Center for Unification as part of the Ministry of Education. So he went through this process of legitimization, becoming, frankly, a part of the South Korean elite. And he's very unique in that sense and probably the only one that comes to mind. He was a member of the North Korean elite. His father was a minister of construction. His mother was a professor at the top university in North Korea, Kim Il-sung University. And Mr. Cho himself graduated from Kim Il-sung University. So for him to defect to South Korea in a fairly short period of time, rise to the ranks in terms of the South Korean elite, this is a story that, again, is a testament to the vibrant democracy in South Korea, despite some of the societal hurdles against defectors that many of them face.
So despite being an elite member of North Korea and then joining the elite in South Korea, what perspective will he bring as a North Korean to the South Korean table? Because I would imagine that many would struggle to adapt to this, you know, bewildering nation that they've just entered.
That's correct. And the greater bewilderment are for the first generation of defectors. If you look at that population of 23,000 defectors in South Korea right now, the first major wave, essentially after the Great Famine in the late 1990s. And if you look at the members of that generation of defectors, really they were the victims of food shortage and whatnot. And what they knew of North Korea was a shock when they learned the truth when they got to South Korea. The second generation of defectors in the second wave that came over in basically the early 2000s, they had seen some of the deprivations and whatnot, but essentially they knew a little more, but not that much more than the first generation. The third generation is remarkable because these individuals operate in the informal markets, conduct a lot of commerce across the border in China. So when it comes to access to information and whatnot, Mr. Cho is unique because as a member of the North Korean elite, he had access to what essentially were the facts of the international system and the situation on the Korean Peninsula. So what he brings to his job as a lawmaker in South Korea now is a very unique perspective of knowing what it's like to live and basically sustain a type of lifestyle in North Korea, even if you are pampered, the type of closed-mindedness in this regime.
So has he been positioned within the political game as the voice of the defector, or is he just trying to get elected on the basis of being Mr. Cho?
Yeah, first and foremost, the support that he got from the ruling party, the Conservative Party, it's been rebranded. The new name is now New Frontier Party. Before, it was the Grand National Party. This is a conservative party that has supported human rights and has taken a very strong stance with North Korea on human rights. So Mr. Cho is seen as a success story for South Korea, but for the conservative New Frontier Party, he is seen as a symbol in terms of South Korea's approach to dealing with North Korea on human rights. And this is in direct contrast to the criticism that even Mr. Cho levels against the liberal governments of the previous two administrations, where he felt that there was almost unconditional aid just for dialogue, and that North Korean human rights very much took the back seat. And as a result, the human rights cause was hurt quite a lot. So this will be a major focus of his tenure in government as a lawmaker.
So, I mean, he's also saying that he hopes that if he is elected, that this will have some great influence on the elite in the North. Is that not arguably a slightly naive stance to take?
It is an ambitious one, but, you know, there's a pro and con type of analysis here. The pro is that it is a factual case. This is not a contrived story in South Korea and somehow being used to create a different type of image in North Korea of the defector community. This is factual, and that is a huge achievement in terms of the defector community, but also Mr. Cho in his new environment. But the con of all this is that, unfortunately, North Korea remains a very tightly controlled country. And with that, radio penetration from broadcast by Radio Free Asia and Voice of America, two government-funded organizations in the United States, has a limited range. And so for the elites in North Korea, they may still interpret this as just Mr. Cho being a puppet of the South Korean regime. But as his activities in the National Assembly in South Korea receive more and more coverage, and the day-to-day workings of a lawmaker are introduced in North Korea, this is a very important way to have an access point in terms of the operations of democracy.
And will this actually encourage any more openness? Or, in fact, will no one in North Korea ever get to hear about the activities of Mr. Cho, his wife included?
This is the amazing thing right now. With the greater commercial interaction between China and North Korea, there's a great deal of flow of information, predominantly related to commercial information, the price of goods, scarcity of issues, of particular items where you'll see an increase of commercial activities. And on the back of that commercial flow, the information related to these commercial flows, you're getting more and more information about the outside world getting into North Korea. You know, so it is a tragic personal story where Mr. Cho left his wife behind when he defected. But the broader access of information, this is going to be a compelling story. So I think it is a function of what he does as a National Assembly member that will offer the greater potential to have access to the elites in North Korea.
John Park, thank you very much indeed for joining us. That was John Park, Research Fellow at Harvard's Belfer Center. You're listening to Midori House.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly business briefing, looking at the most inspiring people, places and ideas from around the world. Whether it's a bookshop owner in Toronto with a smart new business model, a fast food entrepreneur taking Japan by storm, or a local bank CEO providing microfinancing in Kenya, our correspondents and editors are on hand to provide insight into self-started success. Each week we'll be talking to enterprising people who have taken the leap and followed their dreams to set out on their own.
This is not just purely a business. This is a lifestyle. It's fun. It's great. I wake up in the morning, every morning, excited about what are these crazy ideas going around in my head.
From branding your company to finding startup financing and surviving the tough times, we cover the full range of what it takes to turn an idea into a thriving business. All told through personal stories from real people finding success by following their ambitions.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet. It started with a shop in London's Marylebone, and now Monocle also has stores in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and a shop-in-shop in Osaka. And then there's the Monocle Cafe in Tokyo. Come in to find exclusive collaborations with brands we believe in, from Barena jackets to Porter luggage. Great for gifts, even better for personal treats. And if you're missing an issue from your Monocle archive, we can soon fix that. Visit monocle.com for store addresses and opening times. The Monocle shop, carefully crafted design, proud of its provenance.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. The time is just creeping up to 17 minutes past the top of the hour. Time for some music. This is Could You by Daniel Merriweather. Daniel Merriweather there on Monocle 24, and this is Could You? You're listening to Midori House. Now, every election campaign tries to whip up excitement. For most of us, that means enduring endless slogans. Some of the phrases are outstanding. For example, Abraham Lincoln encouraged us to vote yourself a farm. Months before the Wall Street crash, Herbert Hoover promised a chicken in the pot and a car in every garage. Other gems include don't be a girly man, vote Republican, and immigration is a problem, just ask an Indian. In 2008, for Barack Obama, it was the more simple, yes we can, with the hope and change slogan. This year, however, Obama is believed to be pinning his hopes on fair share. Well, to tell us more, we have Sasha Eisenberg, Monocle's man in Washington, to tell us more. Sasha, welcome to Midori House. When did the fair share emerge? It's not an official slogan quite yet, is it?
No, it's not an official slogan. It's a theme that's been coming up in Obama's speeches since last fall. He gave a big speech in Kansas in December, in which he, and this was sort of in the wake of the Occupy Wall Street protests that had taken place around in New York and around the country throughout the fall, increasingly pushing the idea that central to his campaign was an idea of equality, especially for the middle classes, who he argued had been left behind in some of the economic change in this country, and a real way of positioning his race against, what'll most likely be Mitt Romney in the fall as this kind of battle between middle class priorities and Wall Street priorities. And so those fair trade themes have been sort of seeping through in a lot of Obama's language. It's not going to be something that we see on posters, I don't think, or on a big banner behind him at the convention, but I think it'll be a type of recurring piece of language that tells voters what they can expect from a second term if he gets it.
It has a double side to it, though. It could possibly mean, you know, should we do our fair share? Should we contribute? And that, I imagine, is connected to Obama's proposal for a Buffett law, which means that millionaires and billionaires don't pay less in taxes as a share of their income. But it also has a more hopeful angle to it, as we should all get our fair share under an Obama administration. Which of those two do you think he's angling for, or could it be both?
I think it could be both. I think there's been there's a sort of successful theme that Bill Clinton ran on in 1992 that was, he would talk about for people who work hard and play by the rules, you know, government should work for them. And I think that there's folks on the left in the United States have often a difficulty of being perceived as supporting social welfare programs, handouts for people who aren't deserving. And so I think the fair share with that sort of two-sided idea that the more advantaged owe something and that hardworking middle-class people are owed something back is a way of trying to create a moral language about people being deserving of what they get from government and not just entitled to it in the way that liberals have often been attacked for supporting welfare programs.
Commentators have already been saying that the slogan already needs some work to get people's imaginations, but obviously you can get some well-paid advisors in to help him with that. Do you think Obama actually needs a slogan like Hope and Change and Yes We Can in order to reignite imagination, or can he sort of sit back slightly from that?
No, I mean, you know, despite the kind of couple of the great historical examples that you cited early on, we don't have the same culture of sort of sloganeering in our campaigns here that you see definitely in Europe. I think, every general election campaign in the UK, the parties come out with a slogan that they put on posters. It's a big deal in France. We see when in this presidential campaign, when a candidate unveils their poster, and part of that is that there's a poster culture in other countries that we don't necessarily have here. We have signs. Often they have very little more than the candidate's name or the office that they're running for. The year, usually in some combination of red, white, and blue. And one big difference that you have, mentioning advisors, between the U.S. and other sort of developed democracies where I think slogans play a bigger part is that there's a lot less influence of commercial advertisers and marketers in our campaign. We have, you know, an immense political consulting complex of people who just work on political campaigns. But we don't have the type of thing recurringly in the way that you have, like, Sachi always has a relationship with the Tories, where you have folks who are doing consumer advertising the rest of the year and then are drawn into campaigns when they pop up on the calendar. And so because of that, I think there's less of a need that you need a catchphrase or a slogan. There's so much political communication in this country that campaigns are more intent on having what they'll call a message or a narrative that kind of seeps into their ads and their speeches than just having a few words that they can distill on the sign. And so I think Obama, you'll definitely see these thematics go through the year, but you might not see them ever sort of crystallized neatly the way that somebody would have a tag phrase for a soda.
I mean, you mentioned that the Saatchis and the Tories relationship, that it brings to mind the New Labour, New Danger campaign from 1997, when people were less put off by the fact of there wasn't the existence of the word danger in the slogan, but were in fact more attracted by the idea that there was in fact something new to break the past. To break the continued administration by the Conservatives, there is the risk that it can go horribly wrong, isn't there?
Yeah, there is, and I think that there's a lot less, because there's a lot less artfulness and wit in the types of slogans that American campaigns have used them, to the extent that they have. There's far less of the downside of misinterpretation or things sort of carrying deceptive underlying meetings or conflict, and we have much longer campaigns. I mean, one thing you see in the UK is an election pops up, there's a 30-day campaign, and so the need is for the party to represent itself in election mode takes place really quickly, and you need to pivot into going from speaking in the language of governing at Westminster to the language of campaigning. And so how a party decides to distill where it stands at a moment in time in 6 or 8 or 12 words is a big deal in that type of election. We have 2 years of this. And so I feel like there's a lot less of a burden to draw contrast that just work on a bumper sticker the way you might have it in other countries.
Let's turn to the Republicans. I mentioned at the beginning of this item that there was once a phrase which was "don't be a girly man, vote Republican." One hopefully assumes that Republicans have become a little more enlightened since then. But I read there a couple of days ago that with regards to Mitt Romney, the press has spotted that he's getting a little bit more electoral in his vernacular. Apparently, he's overhauled his rhetoric about Obama and has offered a new slogan: "Obama's government-centered society." Now, that doesn't necessarily smack you between the eyes straight away, does it?
No, I mean, I think you know, Romney has this sort of strategic challenge to take his business world experience, which they once thought was a sort of unalloyed asset in talking about the economy. But it's become sort of poisoned ever since the attention paid to Bain's private equity businesses has turned into something of a villain with regards to American manufacturing. So I think they want to have a contrast between what they see as a life that Obama has led that does not involve private sector jobs, and they say sort of in terms of policy depends on relying government to create things. And the point of contrast being Romney's working in the private sector and trusting the market to create jobs. And so I think that they're still sort of casting about for a way to talk about that contrast that doesn't rely too heavily on the particulars of Romney's private sector experience. And so that government-centered society, which you're right, did not roll off the tongue, I think is sort of a way of getting there. I can't imagine it's where they sort of end up. I mean, one thing that's really telling, one of the few slogans that the campaign seems to have sort of stuck to this year is there are folks in Romney's headquarters in Boston who have been using the phrase "Obama isn't working," and they're taking it, you know, straight off of, speaking of Saatchi, the "Labor isn't working" poster of the, I guess it was the 79 campaign. And at one point, the Romney people even mocked up an image that had people standing in an unemployment line, and they had actually plucked the image directly from a conservative poster from the 70s. And so it was quickly noted that the people waiting in this ostensible 2012 American unemployment line look a lot like Brits from the 70s, and they scrapped that imagery pretty quickly.
Sasha, we'll have to leave it there. Sasha Eisenberg, thank you very much indeed for joining us, as always, on Monocle 24. That was Sasha Eisenberg, Monocle's Washington correspondent. You're listening to Midori House.
LDN TYO. NYC MT4.
In the next half hour here on Midori House, we'll be joined in the studio by our culture editor Robert Bound to hear some of his favourite music from this week. But before all that, here's James with the latest news headlines.
The UN Security Council has agreed to a statement calling on Syria to comply with a forthcoming deadline to halt fighting and withdraw its forces from centres of population. Susan Rice, US ambassador to the UN, said if Syria was not willing to comply with the demands in the statement, then the Security Council would consider further steps. Meanwhile, the opposition Syrian Observatory for Human Rights has reported that at least 33 people, including 14 soldiers, have been killed, 16 of them in the city of Homs and 14 in Idlib province. Greek bank shareholders are under pressure from Athens to contribute billions of euros to recapitalise the lenders so that the government can avoid taking them over. Investors will find out next week the details of the financial support package on offer from the Greek government, which desperately wants to keep the banks in private hands. The French president, Nicolas Sarkozy, has published his economic manifesto for re-election, promising spending cuts and a new law committing France to balanced budgets. Recent opinion polls suggest he's moved slightly ahead of his main rival, the socialist François Hollande, but analysts believe Mr. Hollande still seems likely to win the second round. The president of Malawi, Bingu wa Mutharika, is in a critical condition after suffering cardiac arrest. He's expected to be airlifted to South Africa for treatment. Around 200 reporters who covered the war in Bosnia have gathered in Sarajevo to mark the 20th anniversary of the beginning of the siege of the city, the longest siege of a capital in modern history. Popular understanding in the Western democracies about what the war was about was often wrong, according to the correspondent Roy Gutman. And the anti-Konya group Invisible Children has released a new video as a follow-up to the viral Konya 2012 film aimed at waking up the world to atrocities committed by Ugandan rebel leader Joseph Konya and his Lord's Resistance Army. A spokesperson for Invisible Children said he wanted people to dig deeper into this conflict and actively engage in the solutions. Those are the headlines at Monocle 24.
James, thank you very much indeed. And James will be back in a little under half an hour with a full roundup of the world news. Well, every day on Midori House, we're joined by a different editor from the Monocle team. Today, Robert Bound, our culture editor.
Hi, Emma.
Thank you for coming.
That's all right. I'm just going to do that. Oh, that's better.
That's good.
That's a bit short.
It looked a bit uncomfortable. Thank you for doing it on air.
That's all right.
It's lovely.
I didn't want to sort of crash the news.
No.
I didn't want to do anything unprofessional like that.
It would slightly odd.
Yeah,
it
exactly.
Sounded slightly odd.
Because you can raise your chair and then sort of sigh. And as long as everyone knows you're doing it, it's okay, right?
It's absolutely fine. You can do it to you ever you like, my love. You're bringing us the latest on culture this week.
I'm bringing you the latest on culture this week, and I feel like you might have been slightly inundated with Damien Hirst, but I am the culture editor, so I sort of have to give you my two pennies worth.
What's your 2 pennies worth on Hirst?
Oh, it's good, isn't it? It's quite nice going to a show that's called just called Damien Hirst. It's quite weird. It's quite strange when you get the invitation in the post, and you get the catalogue, and it just says Damien Hirst on it. It's not called something like an amazingly cool prog rock album cover or album name, like all of his shows have previously been called. Do you know what I mean? It's not clever, it's just Damien Hirst retrospective, which is kind of nice.
Is this him trying to be fresh? You know, there's a fresh take on him, though, by being not clever.
Sort of, possibly so, yeah, and seeing a collection of stuff that's all kind of all muddled together and showing his best stuff is obviously the best way of putting together, is obviously what you're meant to do when you do a retrospective, but because it's not a selling thing, because it's not a White Cube or a Gagosian show, because it's a show in a national museum, it's kind of a little bit more, it's necessarily sober. But funny, but still all the funny good bits that you always liked.
And it possibly is necessarily sober, but there are little twists on it that I think I read somewhere that the gift shop has a skull for 36,000 British pounds. I mean, there is still a little... It's sober but brash at the same time.
There are things in the gift shop that are worth more money than some of the things on the walls in other shows.
Right.
That's what's weird.
And is that necessarily a good thing? I mean, forgive me to sort of ask you to pass a sort of moral judgment on it,
know
but it is confusing.
It is a confusing thing. And I wonder I wonder how many of those things there are. I'd quite like to know. That's a question which we should delve into that next week.
We should
week,
go and find that, do a bit of investigation.
Morally, I think it's part and parcel of Damien Hirst, isn't it, I suppose. I suppose that's what happens.
The show was absolutely ripped to pieces by Brian Sewell in London's Evening Standard.
He
said, to own a Hirst is to tell the world that your bathroom taps are gilded and your Rolls Royce is pink, and all those who care for living things should boycott this exhibition.
Well, Brian Sewell kind of, I think he's...
Not a fan?
No, I don't think he's ever really been a fan. He hasn't been a fan since even the Sensation shows and all the rest of it. I think he's sort of a famous Hirst naysayer and doesn't like lots of things, I think. But I suppose he's in order to get some... Some people have said, you know, obviously good things, some people have said bad things. I think you can't deny... The fact that it's the Cultural Olympics, isn't it? That's what London thinks that's part of its cultural Olympics.
Sewell doesn't like lots of things, but is there an underlying point to what he's saying? That there is a, like we're going to brash, but brash to the point of actually being quite obscene?
It's weird. I think that lots of people, there was someone, Julian Spalding, I think, wrote in The Independent a couple of weeks ago as well, that, you know, now is the time to sell because, you know, there's a lot of Hirsts. There's a lot of Hirsts. And I think possibly having one, over your mantelpiece is the very wealthy version of sort of like, big dick kind of, you know, it's like having
big dick art.
Well, it's kind of like having a red Porsche parked outside.
Fantastic.
Like possibly. But
actually, I haven't asked you actually what is in the show of this big dick art.
It is it's a number of big dicks. The biggest, of course, being the physical impossibility of death in the mind of someone living, which is the shark. There's the skull, which is called For the Love of God, which sits in the turbine hall, which is a pretty amazing, which is a great thing.
Amazing space.
You walk in there and it's the tiniest thing. It's a human head in this tiny. So it is it's a beautiful thing, and that's sort of one of the points of this thing, is that it is about, you know, sticking diamonds on something that's dead and died, you know, dozens of years ago, which possibly is a metaphor for the art, but, you know, I guess we know who's laughing, why that skull's got a smile on its face.
Well, I was about to say, this is an exceptional example of money. So where does the money come in?
Well, he's a mid-career artist, but in the middle of his mid-career, you know,
suddenly shifts in his
30s, yeah.
Cash.
Yeah.
You know, the pink Rolls Royce.
Yeah, exactly. That's been driven into his own swimming pool, possibly. But this came in with sort of certain with the, some of the skull paintings and the repetition. And I think basically his studio became a factory. That's when the money came in and all the rest of it. And then, of course, when you're interviewed, you can talk about the fact that you're riffing on money as a thing. I mean, Warhol did this, Duchamp did this, all sorts of people have done this before, but not so explicitly or successfully as Damien.
Well, it's incredibly self-referential. I mean, the idea of the factory is the idea of he becomes his own brand. And then this whole introduces the argument of when does an artist make his own work?
Yeah, exactly. And I suppose, you know, Hearst would say that, in the Renaissance, people never did that. You know, Tintoretto and Titian didn't do that either. But, you know, but people still these days feel like an artist should be a skinny guy or girl starving in a garret somewhere. You know, they should be that great portrait of Chatterton. But actually, we all know that they're rock stars, right?
They are all rock stars.
They're not all rock stars, but he is. But he's not got a rock star album cover this time around.
But you have an album with you.
Oh, I've got
a beautiful segue for you.
That's a very good segue. Well, our friends from Kitsune, or one of our mates from Kitsune, the record label and the clothing brand we're in last week, Messiah.
Tyler did an interview with them.
Indeedy. So I thought we'd play
the
first track.
Did you steal the CD on the way?
Yeah, this was hanging out of his trendy bag. This was hanging out of his man bag. I thought I'd take this. I've never listened to it before, I'll be honest with you. No, I have. This is a cool thing. I don't know why it's taken. This must be their sort of 18th compilation or something, Kitsune. And they've never done anything specifically American before. This is called Kitsune America. That's the name of the new compilation. And this is track one from it. It's by St. Lucia, who I think is Afrikaans and then moved to Williamsburg. Because there's no other place you can make music, as we all know. And this is called Before the Dive.
Kitsune on Monocle 24, as recommended by our culture editor, Robert Bound. Stay with us here on Monocle 24, when in a moment we'll be talking about Yale in Singapore.
The menu is Monocle's delectable food and drinks programme with me, Markus Hippi. On the menu, you'll find out about delicious edibles and mouth-watering drinks. We traverse the globe in search of the pioneers, making a stir amongst the food connoisseurs. We hunt down the wonderful and, sometimes weird, tasty trends that are making a buzz in the food industry.
We've been sort of traveling and collecting stories and collecting projects. So one of the things we hope to do is to connect all these narratives across these different geographies.
Milan to Tokyo, Buenos Aires to Auckland. Each week we send our correspondents to the far-flung corners of the world. We pop into independent bakeries, butchers and wineries to find people passionate about what they make. From French cheese to Bulgarian wine, from Japanese chocolates to South African caterpillar snacks. The menu premieres every Friday at 1900 hours GMT. Join us for a drink where everything is on the menu.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug. With a team of 25 dedicated correspondents and bureaus in Zurich, Tokyo, Hong Kong and New York, Monocle 24 keeps you fully informed on events around the world, around the clock.
For Monocle in Caracas, I'm Sarah Granger.
For Monocle in Abu Dhabi, I'm Christopher Lord.
For Monocle in New York, I'm Aisha Spears.
For Monocle in Tel Aviv.
In Sao Paulo.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Manama. In Paris.
In Ramallah.
For Monocle in Hong Kong, I'm Liv Levichnik.
Bangkok.
Los Angeles.
In London.
Buenos Aires.
In Bogota.
In Toronto.
In Laetitia.
Keeping an eye and an ear on the world. This is Monocle 24.
They're hiring at Yale. No great news there, one might think. But for their Singapore faculty, the job offers have gone out, the students are signing up. So it's arguably not a very good moment for some academics to object to the fact that the new campus will be based in a place where homosexuality is illegal and drugs offenders could face execution. The argument about the Singapore project has now broadened to a more fulsome debate about non-discrimination and civil liberties. Well, I'm joined now on the phone by Max de la Bruyere. He's editor-in-chief of the Yale Daily News, the university's newspaper. A very warm welcome to you, Max, to Midori House. Just explain to us, how long has this Singapore project been on the cards?
Well, the first prospectus for it was issued in September 2010. And then last year, the Yale president made an announcement saying that it was signed and it was going forward. But the debate has only really picked up in the last couple of months.
So why have the objections begun now?
It's a good question, and it's a little confusing why now. As you just mentioned, job offers are going out. They're already recruiting students. We're at a point where the university, the college is going to be built, whatever people at Yale say or not. But I think the reason the faculty are talking now is a combination of frustration over Singapore and frustration over the fact that they were not a part of the decision-making process in constructing the Singapore campus.
So on the one level, it's procedural, and then the other level, it's integral to the actual project itself. Let's look at the procedural section. What are the arguments there? The fact that possibly they haven't been consulted, is that right?
Exactly. The faculty did not vote yes or no on this project. The project was entirely done by the Yale administration and by the Yale Corporation, which is the Yale sort of board of trustees. And so some faculty argued that because this is a matter that will affect the college, Yale College, they should have had a vote on Yale and U.S. College.
So let's move on to the more substantive difficulties. The objections, are they to do with the fact that Yale and its professors may be restricted in Singapore by what they may or may not be allowed to do or talk about? Or is it possibly a more general objection to dealing with the state whose laws aren't acceptable to them?
I think it's a combination of those two things. There's an argument among many faculty that there is not a record of freedom of speech, of other freedoms in Singapore that can really support a thriving liberal arts college like Yale wants to build there. They say that it's a combination of restrictions on academic freedom and the fact that academic work about the Singapore government might be censored if it's too critical. There's a question of gay rights in Singapore, because Singapore has a law on the books, although it is argued that the law is not enforced that makes homosexuality illegal. There's also an argument that some of the defense to those criticisms is that this new Yale and U.S. college will be separate from those restrictions, will be a bubble of free speech. But then critics take it a step further and say, look, just because it's a bubble doesn't mean it's a good thing. The academia can't be fenced off from the real world. And if this liberal arts college is only going to be able to be free within its walls, that's not acceptable.
Has it been considered that the likes of New York University have campuses in Shanghai and Abu Dhabi? So what makes Yale and Singapore so different?
And the funny thing about the New York University campus in Abu Dhabi is that I think it also issues NYU degrees, whereas Yale in U.S. is not going to issue Yale degrees. So Yale is actually, in a way, less involved in this new campus than New York University is at Abu Dhabi. And people, I think the argument here about Yale versus NYU is just simply, we're not NYU. We should hold ourselves to our own standard, and we recognize that globalization is something to be desired and probably a good thing, but this is not a country that we feel comfortable putting Yale's name in.
It is fairly inevitable, though, that the globalization of education is going to take Yale all over the world, though, isn't it?
Yes, and that's been a hallmark of the current president's presidency. Yale, new centers in New Haven for the study of international diplomacy, for the study of grand strategy. He's really pushed to make students study abroad. So yes, there's been a big focus on campus of globalization. And I think that you have a lot of faculty right now saying, okay, we do think it's a good thing, but is Yale and U.S. a step too far or a step in the wrong direction?
Isn't there a counter-argument that the people objecting to Yale in Singapore really don't have a right to start telling either the Singaporeans or those working in Singapore how to operate?
Absolutely. There are people on the other side say a variety of things, one of which is, yes, we shouldn't be promoting an us versus them ideology here. We shouldn't be saying we know what's right and it's up to us to show the Singaporeans this path to freedom. There's also an idea that, look, this is not a society in which there is an idea of a liberal arts education. And even if a society is not perfect, neither is the U.S. So if we have this chance to bring a liberal arts college to Singapore, and we have the chance to bring a philosophy education to Singapore, we should jump at that chance.
So finally, is this objection going to do anything, or is the campus just going to go ahead anyway?
Well, the vote that the faculty is planning on having today is on a resolution that merely says that Yale and U.S. College should uphold principles of non-discrimination and civil liberties. It's not one that says yes or no to the campus. So no, it won't have any direct effect on what happens going forward. I think it's more of a symbolic question of let's urge Yale as a faculty, you know, who are central to this university, to make sure that Yale and Yale and U.S. really fight for the civil rights that we believe are integral to a liberal arts institution.
Max, thank you very much indeed for joining us. That was Max de la Bruyere. He's editor-in-chief of Yale Daily News, the university's newspaper. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's 10 minutes before the top of the hour and time for a bit more music. This is Once in a Lifetime by Talking Heads. That was Talking Heads and Once in a Lifetime. You're listening to Midori House. It's 6 minutes towards the top of the hour here on Monocle 24. Every week at Monocle, we like to go out and meet our neighbours to get to know some of the thriving local businesses that surround Midori House here in Marylebone. This week, we went to our local branch of the famous dance studio's Arthur Murray. We spoke to their managing director, Rio Elasia, and he explained to us why ballroom dancing is so in fashion.
My name is Rio Azir. And I'm the managing director of Arthur Murray Dance Studios in London Baker Street. Arthur Murray is the market leader in teaching ballroom and Latin. Started in New York in 1912, and we have over 280 branches worldwide. We just celebrated our 100 years of teaching the world to dance. We have about 60 classes per month. We teach lots of private lessons. We also have practice sessions every week for the students to practice what they have learned. In general, we have more women than men. We do have, you could say we have 65-70% ladies, 30% men. We teach over 18 dances, but we are specialized in partner dancing. And we teach all the ballroom dances such as the tango, the waltz, the foxtrot, the quick step, Viennese waltz, and Latin dances. We teach rumba, cha-cha, pasodoble, samba, jive, swing, merengue, salsa, bachata. We also do the Argentinian tango, we do bolero, and a few other dances. I like them all. It's like going to restaurants. So one time you like Chinese, one time you like English food. It just depends. Each dance has its flavor. I love all of them. And it's nice to be able to dance to so many different music of the world and, you know, from different countries, such as salsa comes from Cuba. Argentinian tango comes from Argentina. Jive, swing, all those, they came from America. Foxtrot from America. The ballroom tango started in England and Germany. And Viennese waltz started in South Germany and Austria. So each dance is related to a sort of a country that has that sort of music and has that sort of culture. I love Marylebone Village. It's just, you feel like you are a bit in the countryside. It's tidy, and the people who live in the area are really nice people. And we have lots of students come here. We have lots of professional people, you know. It's not just for kids. We have most of our students are between the age of 30 and 70 years old, or even older, 75 years old, all professional business people. Quick love, quick love. Ballroom dancing is now very famous with the program Strictly Come Dancing on TV, and it's fantastic ballroom dancing because it really helps your body to have a good body line and have a nice posture. It teaches you how to walk properly, how to balance yourself. It's fantastic. It's the best natural exercise you could imagine.
That was Rio Alassia from Arthur Murray Dance Studios here in Marylebone in London. You're listening to Midori House.
This is Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Essa é Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 project, yeah.
Monocle 24, you're welcome.
This is Monocle 24.
Tama on Monocle Coxigumataneria.
The Bropa Jalabat. Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
That's all we have time for this Thursday's edition of Midori House. Today's show was produced by Dawn Trump. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And our studio manager was Toby Hammond. The Monocle Daily will be back at 2200 London time. That's in 3 hours. Ted Kravitz and Andrew Muller will be talking about the trial of 9/11 suspects. The news is next, followed by The Urbanist. Thank you for listening.